I'm Jay Hughes, producer of Change Surfer Radio, and for the next half hour, I'll be your guide to a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. Welcome to Change Surfer Radio. Jermaine Caskio is without doubt the most prolific of the fellows of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies, which is the new parent organization for Change Surfer Radio. And he has a blog called World Changing, which is at worldchanging.org. And it's a blog, a collaborative blog that he shares with about a dozen other writers. And they write about sustainable technology and sustainable science applied around the world, all kinds of telecommunications and energy and agricultural applications, and how they are helping make the world a better place. This is an article that he published in World Changing on January 10th, 2006, called Abrupt Climate Change, How Bad Could It Be? If global warming results in the abrupt climate change scenario of a little ice age in the northern hemisphere, just how bad might it be? A couple of new studies take a look at the paleological evidence to find out. Although the idea of global warming triggering an ice age may be counterintuitive, the science is pretty solid. Melting ice pack in Greenland results in the dumping of large amounts of fresh water right into the path of the North Atlantic warm water flow, resulting in the slowing and eventual cutoff of the circulation. This, in turn, results in lower temperatures in parts of the Northern Hemisphere, with Europe likely to be hit the hardest. Such a pattern has already happened in the past due to the slower natural cycles of global temperatures. The fossil and ice core evidence suggests that the shift from a warm, wet environment to a cold, dry climate could take place over a matter of a few years. Recent findings that the warm water flow may in fact be seeing a dramatic reduction has turned this concept from a theoretical possibility to a very real threat. But what would that world look like? Two studies give us very different images of what might happen. Climate scientists at the Goddard Institute for Space Studies have been able to use a new model of ocean-atmosphere interaction to reproduce the effects of a massive freshwater dump into the North Atlantic that happened 8,000 years ago. The model's results closely matched the geological record and gave researchers new insights into the effects of a thermohaline circulation drop-off. Quote, the researchers prodded their model with a freshwater pulse equal to between 25 and 50 times the flow of the Amazon River in 12 model runs that took more than a year to complete. Although the simulations largely agreed with proxy records from North Atlantic sediment cores and Greenland ice cores, the team's results showed that the flood had much milder effects around the globe than many people fear, including the dramatic shifts in climate predicted in the 2004 movie, The Day After Tomorrow. According to the model, temperatures in the North Atlantic and Greenland showed the largest decrease, with slightly less cooling over parts of North America and Europe. The rest of the Northern Hemisphere, however, showed very little effect, and that temperatures in the Southern Hemisphere remained largely unchanged. Moreover, ocean circulation, which initially dropped by half after simulated floods, appeared to rebound within 50 to 150 years. This was probably the closest thing to a Day After Tomorrow scenario that we could model, said Legrand. The flood we looked at was even larger than anything that could happen today. Still, it's important for us to study because the real thing occurred during a period when conditions were not that much different from the present day. So here's one end of the potential impact spectrum, a minor temperature drop with ocean circulation disruption lasting no more than a century and a half, a blink of the geological eye. This would be a problem to be sure, but not the global civilization disrupting event seen in some scenarios. Unfortunately, other research suggests a far worse result is also possible. Flavia Nunez and Richard Norris, oceanographers at the University of California, San Diego, have produced an article for Nature describing the Paleocene-Eocene thermal maximum event of about 55 million years ago, during which ocean temperature shot up by 7 to 8 degrees centigrade, followed by a rapid change in ocean circulation. The Atlantic circulation saw a disruption of flow lasting a couple of thousand years, then a reversed flow that took 100,000 years to correct. The implication is that a major thermohaline circulation disruption would not be a brief event, but an extremely long-term problem. Although scientists have found, quote, evidence of similar links between ocean current and climate in the last 200,000 years, Woods Hole oceanographer Karen Bice says that the PETM event is a much better analog for the climate change that we see today because it occurred in a world that was warming gradually in response to rising greenhouse gas levels. It's a good indicator of what could happen in our own future, warns Bice. And so Jame goes on, it's notable that the PETM conditions are not known to have triggered an ice age. This is likely because the temperature increase was sufficiently dramatic to melt the undersea methane hydrates, which in turn released a sufficient level of greenhouse gas to keep the global environment quite warm for potentially millions of years. So which is it? Hopefully, the first scenario is the more accurate reflection of the current environment. The second scenario, with melting clathrates boosting global temperatures for millennia at least, would be a far greater disaster than most of us could imagine. It is as yet unclear what would make the difference between a mild, abrupt ice age and an effectively permanent climate disaster. The likely tipping point issue is whether the ocean temperatures get hotter fast enough to melt the clathrates before the cooling effects of the mini ice age can really kick in. That is to say, this is another piece of evidence making it clear that we need to stop making things worse. And again, that's a piece by Jame Caskio, who's a leading blogger and writer on the topic of sustainable development and sustainable technology at the worldchanging.org site, which is a collaborative blog that publishes many wonderful pieces every single day. You can subscribe through RSS there. And also, we publish his articles, just a small fraction of his outflow, at IEET.org, where he is one of the fellows. Another one of the fellows at IEET.org is Dale Carrico, close friend, collaborator on the emerging field of techno-progressivism, and the conference chair of the conference that we're organizing together out at Stanford Law School on human enhancement technology and human rights. Dale has recently published a piece on his blog, Amor Mundi, which is we also republish work from there at the IET site. And his piece is called World Without Work. This will sound a little bit incestuous because he's riffing off of a discussion that we started on the Techno-Liberation website. At any rate, he gets into the meaty substance of his own thoughts shortly after that. According to an article over at BBC News, quote, researchers from Gothenburg University in Sweden have been studying published data on what makes people happy. They believe working to achieve a goal rather than attaining it makes people more satisfied. In a discussion of the article happening on the Techno-Liberation list, friend and ally James Hughes points out that this is the kind of research that Luddites and workerist progressives point to suggest that a post-work basic income society would be bad for us. Hughes also suggests that the study raises questions for many of us who advocate for basic income guarantees as part of our techno-progressive politics. To what extent, he asks, can people shift their work satisfaction motivations and socialization from for-profit labor to voluntary nonprofit labor? Now, it seems to me that a world in which conscript and duressed labor is eliminated by the introduction of a global basic income guarantee wouldn't, in fact, be a post-work world at all. It isn't even clear to me how the question of basic income has much bearing, finally, on the question of whether or not meaningful goal-directed activity is usually an important part of a flourishing person's life. The public provision of a basic lifelong guaranteed income should be thought of, first of all, as the implementation of safeguards against arbitrary misuses of authority in people's workplaces. It would provide everybody with the means to opt out of the current circumstances in which they attain their livelihoods. Thus, it would provide a constant check on misuses of power in the workplaces by institutionalizing a permanent position of security from which workers could renegotiate the terms of their employment and demand redress for abuses without fear of unjust reprisals. It would also encourage people to grow and take chances, try new things, learn new skills, invest in new enterprises to the benefit of all, and all without the threat of utter devastation to bedevil and constrain them. A world with a basic income guarantee would still be a world in which many worked for profit, surely, and in which many more would work voluntarily in projects that are especially important or satisfying to them, or provided unique benefits for them. The fact that most techno-progressive positions on basic income connect it to assumptions about the likely proximate emergence of ubiquitous automation and longevity medicine introduces special complications to our arguments, certainly. But I don't personally think even we techno-progressive types are arguing for a post-work world either, really. I think we are arguing instead for a radicalized version of the liberal world that Alistair MacIntyre once derided, and which Richard Rorty then notoriously defended, as a world of managers, therapists, and rich aesthetes. Even if ubiquitous automation is implementable in principle, I doubt its absolute ubiquity will be achieved precisely because many people will derive a therapeutic benefit from certain kinds of voluntary manual labor, just as they might likewise crave the interpersonal contact afforded in many service and civil service jobs. And I would just say parenthetically here, that may be the case, but it doesn't mean that, as with agribusiness versus gardening in your garden, that you'll be buying your groceries from people who garden in their garden. You'll probably still be buying your vegetables from agribusiness. But at any rate, it seems to me that quite a lot of what people I know seem to mean when they speak of hard work is to register how hard it is to cope with stultifyingly repetitive, palpably meaningless, humiliating jobs in which they are subjected to the whims of capricious authorities in rather futile hierarchical institutional arrangements from which they cannot easily escape if they are to maintain the way of life to which they have grown accustomed. To the extent that the cited study means by work demanding meaningful, goal-directed activity, I fear far too many of us are already in the post-work world. What advocates of basic income seek to do is democratize the authoritarian organization of this post-work world such as it is. The arrival of ubiquitous automation and computation, molecular nanotechnology, and rejuvenation medicine in a progressive and democratic world offer up at last the hope of a life of the rich aesthete for us all. I have little doubt, however, that most of us will still find room in our lives for the valuable and demanding managerial work of democratic citizens engaged in peer-to-peer collaboratory policy assessment and administration. There, I'm not quite so sure, but, and I suspect that there will be a growing and deeply emancipatory space for the therapeutic work that keeps us in touch with the needs of people different from ourselves, work that provides support for others, even as it provides the means to satisfy our own needs, always to become people whose futures will differ in ways we cannot yet completely fathom from our pasts. And of course, Dale is an extremely interesting thinker. And if you didn't catch the full flavor of that just from my reading of it, you can read it at ieet.org. It's World Without Work, published on January 9th. You're listening to Change Surfer Radio, produced by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. And I'm Dr. J. I'm really going to miss Leon Kass, the outgoing chairman of the President's Council on Bioethics. He's a University of Chicago professor who I used to sit across from. I don't know that he would ever recognize me, but I've been enjoying his attacks on human enhancement and reproductive medicine and embryo cloning and all kinds of things since he's been on the President's Council appointed by President George Bush. And he was recently replaced by Edmund Pellegrino, who's a bioethicist, a very senior bioethicist at the Kennedy Institute for Bioethics at the Johns Hopkins University. And Edmund Pellegrino, although a Catholic and opposed to many of the same things that Leon Kass is opposed to, is not quite as controversial as Leon. But I was happy to see that Leon was still beating his drums, and he was recently quoted in a long hagiographic article in the Wall Street Journal called Soul Man, Leon Kass Sounds a Warning About the Perils of Biotechnology by Brett Stevens. It was published on January 7th and is available online. And he beat some of the same drums that he'd been beating while he was on the President's Council. So, for instance, he talks there about performance-enhancing drug use by athletes and suggests that an athlete would never feel good about an accomplishment that they made using performance-enhancing drugs. He critiques parents who might want to use behavior-modifying psychotropic drugs or enhancement pills for their kids. And then he gets on to what is probably the least attractive of his various kinds of anti-technological attitudes, which is his opposition to radical longevity. So he says here, and then there is the matter of dramatically prolonging the average human lifespan. Already, mice have been genetically engineered to produce certain proteins, thereby extending their average lifespan by about a third. Sooner or later, similar genetic manipulations will be safely and usefully available for larger mammals, including humans. The question that will confront us then, says Dr. Cass, is what is wrong with that? Dr. Cass is certainly aware that human longevity increased dramatically in the last century, mainly to good effect, although mostly as a result of declining infant and child mortality. He's also cognizant of the powerful case, intellectual as well as emotional and intuitive, in favor of prolonging lifespans even further. If we lived healthily and our friends lived healthily indefinitely, we could earn more, learn more, see more, and do more, he's quoted as saying. He is also willing to acknowledge that potential socioeconomic consequences of much longer living, such as when does your fit as a fiddle 130-year-old boss retire so that you can take his place, could be resolved in some satisfactory, sustainable way. So far, so good. But, he says, consider the kind of choices that people might make if their biological deadlines were to be extended for decades. How long would our de facto adolescence last? How much longer would we postpone childbearing if many of us didn't abandon the business altogether? How would the balance of social energies tilt between the young and the old? Would it not lead, liberals take note, to an increasingly conservative and perhaps reactionary society? Would not the bulk of human energies turn toward coarse and selfish attempts at self-preservation? Quote, there are very few people who have been around a long time who see anything with fresh eyes, says Dr. Cass. We need to put our weight with the young. And of course, as usual with these kind of extreme right bioethical hand-wringings and questions and many, many concerns, the question is, so what? So you have all these questions and concerns, and you think that maybe society might become more conservative if we lived longer, which it hasn't, but when we lived longer in the last century. But at any rate, it might become more conservative or what, so on and so on. What's the point? Are you going to kill grandma at 90? Are you going to ban a pill that keeps you alive until 130? Are you going to say the FDA can't approve anything that keeps you alive until 130? It's absolutely pointless. Of course, he doesn't want to make that point to the Wall Street Journal because then they wouldn't want to publish an article which called for such restrictions of free enterprise. But that is, in fact, the upshot of Leon's beating of the drum. A more sensible perspective can be found in an article, Aging, Death, and Nanotech, by Mike Treader, who's the executive director of the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology and is a fellow of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technology. And he published an article on this topic in December 28th of 2005. It starts, among the most intriguing research of our time is the effort to understand the process of aging and perhaps to arrest or even reverse its effects. Impressive progress is being made, and here he quotes a news article. It says, genes that control the timing of organ formation during development also control timing of aging and death and provide evidence of a biological timing mechanism for aging, Yale researchers report in the journal Science. Although there's a large variation in lifespan from species to species, there are genetic aspects to the processes of development and aging, said Frank Slack, associate professor of molecular, cellular, and developmental biology and senior author of the paper in Science. We used the simple but genetically well-studied C. elegans worm and found genes that are directly involved in the determination of lifespan. Humans have genes that are nearly identical. According to Slack, there is strong evidence of an intrinsic biological clock that runs for aging as well as for normal organ development. The microRNA is conserved in humans, leading to the enticing idea of being able to beneficially affect the results of aging, including diseases of aging, said Slack. Work is underway to identify other microRNAs, regulators, and genes that they target to determine where they function and whether they behave the same way in mice and to see if they are altered in human diseases of aging. And again, that was from another blog called biosingularity.wordpress.com. It's a quote from the Science, a press release about that Science article. So Mike goes on, Genetic therapy holds great promise for treating several serious human health problems, as well as possibly stopping natural deterioration altogether. However, the current state of the art can also cause problems, including cancer. Eventually, with the use of advanced nanotechnology, scientists may be able to edit the DNA of living cells in the body. But even without that level of sophistication, massively parallel scanning, made possible with tools built by molecular manufacturing, that is, nanotechnology, may enable the sorting of cells modified outside the body. The ability to inject only non-cancerous cells would make some kinds of genetic therapy much safer. Microsurgical techniques could allow the implantation of modified cells directly into the target tissues. Health improvement and life extension do not depend on molecular manufacturing, but it certainly will make possible to make them more accessible to more people. Any treatment that can be automated can be applied to any number of people at low cost. Such efficient research will speed up the development of cures for complex problems such as aging. Mike then addresses a number of the common objections to radical life extension. He says, okay, if everyone were healthy and lived a long time, we'd overpopulate the Earth. Well, in relationship to that one, once infant mortality is minimized, birth rate contributes far more to population than lifespan, because children grow up to have children of their own. But as people get healthier, richer, and better educated, they have fewer kids. The birth rate is already below the replacement level in several rich countries, and I would add in many of the urban areas of the developing world. Overpopulation is a centuries-old problem. Traditionally, it's been solved by infanticide, plague, and vicious war. Molecular manufacturing will allow us to develop far more sustainable lifestyles and figure out better solutions for living in greater numbers on and beyond the Earth. Another objection: life extension is immoral, and we should resist it. Smallpox vaccination, anesthesia, and blood transfusions also were said to be immoral. Today, it's obvious that that's crazy. No one wants to be sick, and life extension is a natural result of health extension. Anyone who visits the doctor is working to improve their health and often trying to increase their lifespan as well. And so on with many of the sensible things that Mike Treader says in his online publication, Responsible Nanotechnology, which is published at the Center for Responsible Nanotechnology. And we repost many of his posts because he's a fellow of the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies. So you can read them there at IEET.org. Another life extension story that's in the news is from the Associated Press, and I'll just read a little bit of it here. A very low-cal diet can help the heart age more slowly, say researchers who released what they call the first human study on the subject. Findings confirmed earlier studies on mice and rats that demonstrate the cardiac benefits of a restricted calorie diet. The study looked at the heart function of 25 members of the Calorie Restriction Society, ages 41 to 64, who consume 1,400 to 2,000 nutritionally balanced calories a day. They were compared with 25 people who eat a typical Western diet, consuming 2,000 to 3,000 daily calories on average. The result, those limiting caloric intake had the heart functions of much younger people, typically about 15 years younger than their age. Ultrasound exams showed that group members had hearts that appeared more elastic than most people their age. Their hearts were also able to relax between beats in a way similar to hearts in younger people. This is the first study to demonstrate that long-term calorie restriction with optimal nutrition has cardiac-specific effects that delay age-associated declines in heart function, said one of the researchers. And the study is published on last Tuesday in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. And this is, of course, principally important not because many people will be following this diet, which is an extremely difficult diet to follow, given that most diets are not very successful. Following a diet that's so restrictive in terms of calories is extremely difficult. It means you could basically eat lettuce all day. But what's important here is that going back to the previous noted research, that it is possible to find the biochemical, hormonal, and genetic triggers within the body that are affected by calorie restriction, and that therefore extend human life expectancy. And hopefully we will be able to turn those on through pharmaceutical intervention and have all the benefits of calorie restriction without having to have the calorie restriction. Hopefully we can do the same thing for exercise as well. Now, of course, from a techno-progressive perspective, one of the key questions here is, okay, we're going to have all this fun stuff coming out which will promise to extend our lives, and do we trust the pharmaceutical industry to sell us things which actually work and which are safe? The previous major human life extension or anti-aging therapy called hormone replacement therapy or estrogen replacement therapy turned out to not actually be that safe for women. And millions of women took this therapy and probably shortened their lives when they thought that they were lengthening their lives or at least significantly alleviating the symptoms of aging and menopause. And that wasn't really the fault of the pharmaceutical industry or of the FDA because it took longer to figure out what the consequences were of estrogen replacement therapy than we had given it time to do. And many women wanted the benefits sooner than it would have taken for the many years of research to be done. But so the question is, how can we improve the drug approval process, the clinical trials process, so that we have good knowledge about which drugs are safe and what their side effects and consequences are, so that we can give them to people who need them in a rapid kind of way without having these massive Vioxx kinds of scandals and debacles. And so this is good news coming out of the FDA. The FDA rules aim to speed drug tests and trim costs. This is a story from the Boston Globe written by one of the Globe staff there on January 13th. And I'll read just a little bit of this. The Food and Drug Administration yesterday issued new guidelines that make it easier for scientists working in universities and small companies to test promising therapies in humans without matching the hefty spending of the large drug companies. The FDA's new standards create an earlier stage of clinical trials that allow researchers to test very small doses of experimental drugs in fewer patients, paring expenses, and drug manufacturers hope providing a quicker way to flag potential failures. Right now, the FDA says 9 out of 10 experimental drugs fail in clinical testing. That can cost companies millions. And many experimental drugs go untested in humans because the current system requires massive investments before the make or break stage of drug development. This will allow us to test a broader variety of compounds in people earlier and then pick the best one for taking forward, said Dr. Janet Woodcock, the FDA's Deputy Commissioner for Operations. The FDA's declaration came as drug companies were still digesting the agency's sobering news for 2005. The FDA approved a mere 20 new drugs last year, compared with 36 approvals during the previous year. From 2002 to 2004, newly approved drugs took an average of 8.5 years to work their way through the clinical trials to earn FDA approval. If the length of clinical trials were shaved by 25%, drug manufacturers would save $129 million per new drug approved, according to recent research from Tufts, which put the cost of developing a new drug at $802 million. Having the time spent on clinical trials would lower drug development costs by 29%, saving drug companies $235 million per drug approved. So it is extremely important that we all, progressives, conservatives, libertarians, everybody, take a good look at how we can improve the FDA drug approval process, because it is enormously expensive, prohibitively expensive for many of the more experimental drugs for them to get to market. And we do want them to be safe when they get to market. We want to know how safe they are and who they're effective for and who they're not. And so we want to create a system that allows new innovation to come and benefit our lives, but at the same time is safe. You've been listening to Change Surfer Radio, a sexy high-tech vision of a radically democratic future. Brought to you by the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies and produced at WHUS Stores at the University of Connecticut. I'm Jay Hughes, the host and producer of Change Surfer Radio and executive director of the IEET. If you want to learn more about the techno-progressive perspective of Change Surfer Radio and the IEET, or you want to share your thoughts about our programs, email me at director@ieet.org. You can find the Institute for Ethics and Emerging Technologies at ieet.org. You can subscribe to a weekly podcast of Change Surfer Radio and listen to or download all of our shows since 1998, thanks to the Infos Radio Project at the Change Surfer website at changesurfer.com. So educate, agitate, and organize, and I hope to meet you in a sexy, high-tech, and yet radically democratic future.